Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm Net Control Operator for this, the Limelock Technical Net. Limelock Technical Net has been going strong for about 43 years now. Sunday night at ACF, we'll gather in front of the radio and hopefully inform each other, learn, entertain, what have you. So I thank everyone who is arriving here tonight on this Passover and Easter edition of the Limelock Technical Net. I hope you learned something. I hope you teach me something. I hope you have some fun time. Let me drop for a second, as per usual, and I will give you the usual link. Okay, so if you want to reach me, you can't do it by radio. That email is as good as any. That would be either for what we used to call mailbag questions, which are questions that you can't get in front of a radio to ask, but you can either listen to the audio stream or listen to an archived copy of the audio stream at a later time. Or if you want to bring up a topic, there's sometimes where some topics become very, very famous and popular, and if you have expertise that you want to share, people occasionally will ask if they could come on and do a little presentation on a subject. That's great. Sometimes people want to be part of a conversation about a topic. Other times people know very little about a topic but are curious and want to hear other people talk about it. So if you have a topic for discussion, that's another reason to email me. If you have a puzzle, we're always looking for technical puzzles. They are very, very rare and very, very priceless. I'm looking for technical-related puzzles and questions that cause us to kind of massage our neurons and kind of bring them back to life, preferably not a puzzle that you can Google and get the answer in 10 seconds. It sort of defeats the purpose of the journey being more important than the destination. Or if you want me to tag Paul and you find something that's space or NASA related, you'd like to have his take on it, you can either directly email him at spacenetreport@gmail.com, or for all the above, you can send it to me. My email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. I also maintain a link page with interesting articles, YouTube, all kinds of fun stuff that I collect for the previous week, and then I put them on the page. And at your leisure, they're up 24/7, so any old time, you can go by there, click on, read a couple of articles that I found interesting or YouTube that I found interesting. The link page, you just type into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com. And that'll get you to the link page. We have a chat room. Sometimes it's quiet, sometimes it's noisy. If you can get there, you just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the chat room. We have an audio stream of the Technical Net every Sunday night. And we keep it open for the rest of the week so that if you want to listen to Glen Oaks Repeater but you don't have a radio, but you do have internet access, you type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com. That will bring you an audio stream most of the time. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, don't want to time out now. Also, always want to remind people, MyKC2NJI has a great archive site called AmateurRadio.tv. Has more than a million visitors to it. He has archived the Limelock Technical Net. It goes as far back as September of 2006. So there's a lot of wisdom of a lot of hams who've either moved away from the area or they have unfortunately become silent keys over the years. So avail yourself of their wisdom. It's still very, very useful. Let me drop for a second. I'll be back, and we'll kind of tell you what to expect tonight. Okay. We're going to ask, as per usual, if anyone has any technical questions, especially amateur radio-related questions. I would prefer those to be asked first. But as the night progresses, you can open it up to any aspect of science and technology, and I will try my best to supply some kind of reasonable answer or references to look up reasonable answers. And then about 10:15, Paul will join us for the SpaceNet report, which will take us to about 11 p.m. I will return and wish you all a happy week and tie a little bow tie on it and call it a day. So that's the plan. Let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you a little story. Okay, essentially it's kind of two micro stories. One is, no doubt people have noticed, I run a 10-meter net on Sunday morning. And today, propagation conditions were awful. Europe, I couldn't hear Europe. I couldn't hear the Midwest. It was very common in the old days to contact our own Ken and to VHZ. Out of Nebraska or South Dakota. I would talk to people in Texas. I would talk to people in Oklahoma. I would talk to people in Washington State. Today was Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island. That was it. Until 12:50, when who should appear out of nowhere but Namibia again. I told this story because it happened to be, I think, March 15th or March 12th. V51MA, Mike from Namibia, came on 10 meters, and I needed a little help for relaying the information. He gave me a 5x5 signal report, which is nice. I wish I could hear him as well. So 10 meters is not terribly alive, but even if it isn't alive, you might still be able to talk to Namibia. So who would have thunk it? Let me drop for a sec. Okay, I just want to offer this short cautionary tale. It probably is better suited for the computer net, but I'm here now, so I might as well tell you. I've talked about computers many times on these technical nets, and I'm a belt suspenders and staple gun sort of guy. I have backup software. I back up my stuff every night. I back it up locally, I back it up to the cloud, I back it up to external hard drives. It's all over the place. This past week, I rebooted, and I don't know what the hell happened to my operating system, but all of a sudden, I had to wait for 45 minutes for it to boot up completely. It was just loading things like molasses. And I tried rebooting, and it was just something had mucked up the operating system. And although I could probably spend 5 or 6 weeks or months figuring out what the bunch of things it was, the easiest solution for me is just to restore from one of my many copies. So I tried to, and I failed. And I tried another one, and I failed. And I tried another one, and I failed. And my backup and restore software is very persnickety. It doesn't seem to like different media. It doesn't like SD cards. It doesn't like thumb drives. It doesn't like USB 3.0 external hard drives. And even when I move the files into my hard drive on my desktop, it reported it as not being able to be validated. It listed it as corrupt. So I spent the better part of a day or two uncorrupting it and shearing it down to its bare minimum where it would validate it and restore it. And I'm back to business as usual. And as soon as I got in that condition, I junked my old backup software and moved to a completely different backup software. So the moral of the story is, don't make assumptions. If you're spending good money for a well-recommended piece of software, it doesn't mean it works. If it works to back things up, it doesn't mean it works to restore them. So if you ever have the opportunity to kind of test out the full image restore capability of your backup software, consider doing it so that when you really need to do it, you won't be out of luck. So, couple of little hopeful cautionary tale for you. Drop for a sec. If anyone has any particular comments on what I said before we do the usual call for questions or topics, feel free to hit that button. Now, this is not for questions or topics yet. This is just for any comments about the 10 meters and the computer that I just mentioned. KW3. Yes, Cass.
Okay, I'm just curious, did your system start to appear to be starting up normally and then suddenly stop, or did you get crazy messages, or was it just not for you at all?
It booted, but my first sign of problems was I got this little window that said tablet cannot be loaded, and click OK to get rid of this window. One of the many programs I have installed in this is a Wacom tablet driver. Then, about a minute later, another window pops up that says, your copy of Adobe Creative Cloud is corrupted. Would you like to fix it? And when I clicked the first time, I clicked fix. It went through some things and then said, could not fix. Consider uninstalling and reinstalling. Then the regular screen kind of came up, and I watched as it painfully installed startup programs over the next 45 minutes. It was slow as molasses. You know, I was watching Windows being drawn in real time. It was bad to see.
Yeah, that's certainly ugly. I know I've had similar things happen when either a hard drive or a piece of networking equipment kind of comes offline, and then it's not a matter of things are corrupted, but rather they just waiting for it to become ready.
Yeah, it didn't strike me that this was a hardware problem, and it wasn't even, unfortunately, a CPU problem, because I pulled up the task manager, and the task manager kept on reporting that CPU activity was around 10 to 15%. So it wasn't that there was something that was just ripping the hell out of the CPU cycle. It was just that there were programs or drivers that were kind of looking around for installation or configuration files and not quite finding them, and looking a couple of dozen times and then finding them and then installing them slowly and then hiccuping again. And, you know, it was kind of sad. You know, I would click an icon to start a piece of software, and then I could go and have a snack because it was going to take about 10 minutes for it to load. It got better as time went on because most of the programs were already loaded in memory, and the configuration files and what have you were already dealt with. So after about 4 or 5 hours into using the computer, it was almost tolerable. But I definitely had to do something about it. You know, if unfortunately something gets corrupted, something crashes, and I have to wait a couple of hours to have a usable computer, that's not a something I want to have happen to me or anyone else. So I really was looking to restore it back. I'm really obsessive compulsive when it comes to restore points. I have restore points every night. But unfortunately, if your software is garbage, then you have all the images in the world that you can't validate it and have it run.
Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
Yes, Rich.
I have two things. Restore points, Windows generated restore points are garbage. They never help me restore anything. If you're talking about third-party software restore points, that's a different thing. But Windows restore points, and I even think I read once that, you know, Microsoft admits that the restore points doesn't work. That's number one. Number two, I've had trouble with the Wacom driver. With the Wacom tablet driver. In fact, I do not run that driver unless I'm using the tablet. So I took that out of, you know, the auto start for that driver, there are known issues with the Wacom tablet, Roy. Go ahead.
Well, I tried before, you know, because it took me days to get the restore to restore. So I had a lot of opportunity to try everything else, and one of the many things I did was delete all traces of Wacom Driver. I deleted all traces of Adobe Creative Cloud. It had no effect. It didn't bring up the error window, but it still took 45 minutes to boot up. And I agree with you. Microsoft is infamous for having, pardon my French, half-assed utilities that don't quite work, or they change their mind and they hide them, or they cripple them. I haven't used Restore Point in years because it's such a pain in the backside to get it to do anything useful. This was a Cronus backup. This is an almost commercial piece of software. Businesses rely on this garbage. When I first bought it many, many years ago, it was a very good piece of software. But over the years, these companies have to differentiate themselves by bloating up the software, have it do a whole bunch of useless things rather poorly, and then they lose track of the whole point of it, of being a backup and restore program. And I would go to their web pages and see other people complain that it doesn't like SD cards, it doesn't like USB drives. You can't do simple stuff like that, then you shouldn't be in that business. But no, I did not rely on Microsoft. I relied on a somewhat expensive backup, cloud-based and local-based backup company, Acronis.
Yeah, Microsoft should be shot for that Restore Point garbage.
Well, among other things, I think they have too many corporate heads, so they change their mind every 10 minutes. Sometimes they let us know, sometimes they don't. They take things out, or even worse, they just cripple them. They just make them so that they're almost completely useless without bothering to explain it to anyone. So I learned that lesson many years ago, and I haven't relied on a Restore Point in 6 or 7 years, maybe, and I do that grudgingly. I mean, if it's kind of easy to restore your registry, and I know exactly, you know, that will kind of fix it. In the old days, I would attempt that, but now I don't even bother looking for it because it's hidden under so many layers. And I'm willing to bet you anything, if I ever find it, it will tell me that there's one Restore Point from 1942 and nothing else since then. So, yeah, I agree with you. It's just what Microsoft does. Don't rely on it to do utilities unless it's the latest hot thing. Then they'll rush it into production. You know, they'll give you artificial intelligence on Bing, and they'll lobotomize it when they change their mind, and won't tell you when they're going to fix it. So, again, that's Microsoft. Love them or leave them. Okay, I guess we exhausted my little experiment this week. So please, guys, if you do have backup software, do test it out. You know, think of it like a field day. You never know. You know, one of the many ideas of field day is to test up your equipment in an emergency situation. So simulate an emergency computer situation, and of course, backup, and backup, but with a good backup going well. The worst thing I ever hear is people rely, they have all their memories on one hard drive. That hard drive is a mechanical device. It is prone to fail, and the cost to get the information off of it is not something that regular consumers are going to pay. You know, companies pay thousands of dollars for that service, but I'm not going to spend it. Neither are you. So
Scribble it down someplace. As a reminder, check on your backup options for your computer. The data that you have is very important to you. Anyway, this is AC2GS, and we're open to business. If anyone has any questions, preferably amateur radio-related questions at first, but we'll take anything. Just hit that push the talk button, give me your first name and your call sign.
W2BC.
Rich recognized. Anyone else on the list for tonight?
AD2DU.
Alex recognized. Anyone else want to put their name down for tonight? Okay, perhaps later there'll be some more participants. So, top on the list for tonight is Rich W2BZ. What's your question or topic or comment for tonight, Rich?
Roy, we were talking earlier in the week about that noise reduction box, if you'll remember. Could you go into that again for me, explain how it works and what it's good for and what it's not, and, you know, exactly how is that canceling out noise? I'm not clear on that. Okay?
AC2GS. Sure, Rich. What Rich is talking about, you can see a version of it. MFJ sells a, they might call it a noise canceller. I'm not quite sure what the term is. DX Engineering sells a really shiny modular design version of this. Are not digital signal processing chips that are usually applied either to the IF stage or the audio stage that use computer algorithms. They digitize the audio stream and then they analyze it for random noise or non-random noise, and they have a whole bunch of different algorithms. That's a different kettle of fish entirely. This particular device works on the very front end of the radio receiver. What it effectively does is it has two antenna ports. One of them is your receiving and could be transmitting antenna. The other is a lesser antenna that picks up noise. It's not really designed to be particularly resonant for your signal. In fact, it works better if it can't pick up your signal, if it just picks up the noise without the signal. Then you have a series of phase inverting circuits and gain controls and knobs that allow you to inject two signals together in some form of comparator that compares the two signals and will phase out the noise from the noise and signal. And the idea is to end up just with the signal and have a much better signal-to-noise ratio and much lower noise floor and all kinds of fun things. So that's the theory. The problem is that it's very difficult to get a separate signal that just has the signal stripped away. You're either going to strip a lot of the noise away with that other antenna, or you're going to have a lot of the signal end up as part of the noise signal input. If you invert the phase and you add a signal to a signal, then you're going to decrease obviously your signal along with the noise and defeat the purpose. So in a perfect world where you can design an antenna that will only pick up the noise and none of the signal, it would be a wonderful device. But because no such thing exists in real life, you kind of have to fudge it. You can null out vocal noise, but not all the noise.
How do you determine what's local noise and what's not local noise? And if it's mostly not local noise, the noise reduction isn't as beneficial? Again, how do you know the local noise from the distant noise, and how is that distant noise generated?
The distant noise can be generated in the same way that the local noise is, but it's created in more distance, and it's part of the transmission that you're receiving either with the ground wave propagation or the ionospheric skywave propagation. Noise on a given frequency surrounding a signal can be refracted by the ionosphere and propagated just like the signal itself. The way that you can tell local noise is because you will not need a decent antenna to pick it up. It'll be nearby and, you know, just a random length of relatively short wire will pick up a lot of local background electromagnetic noise in your environment. It will have a tougher time being able to pick up skywave propagated noise and you know, longer distance noise. So, you know, if you have something like a rotary saw going off about 6 feet away from you, you're going to pick that up on a little sub-whip antenna, whereas the noise produced near the site of the station you're talking to, you won't pick up on such an antenna. And the less noise you're able to pick up on the sensing antenna, the less noise you're going to be able to invert and phase out.
But you're saying it'll only invert and phase out local noise. It won't invert and phase out distant noise?
I wouldn't phrase it like that. It will only invert and phase out noise that it's able to receive. And because the sensing antenna tends to not be a particularly good antenna, it's not very sensitive for more distant signals. That's the idea. You don't want to introduce the signal into the sense antenna because you don't want to phase it out and therefore attenuate it. You only want to attenuate the noise. But it's very difficult to differentiate the signal at a distance from noise at a distance. It's a lot easier to screw around with a suboptimal sensing antenna that's reasonably good at picking up local noise.
Okay, and what's the actual process of comparing two different noises and phasing them out? What noise does it leave alone, and what noise does it phase out? I know you said that it's distant noise that it won't phase out. So in other words, if you had two identical beams on a tower and used one as a sensing antenna, that wouldn't work too well. Am I correct about that?
Correct. You could probably simulate the same thing by using a splitter on a single antenna. So by splitting it, you're dropping each output to 3 decibels, but it's identical. Then the problem is if you invert it and then put it into the amplifier to null out the second antenna signal, you're attenuating the noise, which is good, but you're also equally attenuating the signal, which is bad. You end up effectively with the same signal-to-noise ratio as if you didn't have any of that expensive equipment at all.
So if you're in a very noisy environment, if you're in the middle of Manhattan, something like this would do better. Or I think you're, Roy, aren't you in a very noisy environment?
Not particularly. I mean, sometimes yes, sometimes no. I have occasionally local causes for weird RF that kind of wiggles around on my fan adapter. It's not a transmitter per se. It's just a parasitically oscillating circuit in someone's electronics. And of course, I'm about two blocks away from the Coney Island subway system. There's a lot of electrical equipment, I'm sure, that they use down there. But, you know, all things being equal, it's not awful. It would be better if I was out in the country. Whenever you talk to guys who move from the city to the country, one of the things that amazes them is the noise floor just kind of dropped down by a bunch of S-signals. It'll help to a degree, but as I unfortunately tend to tell people, it is not a panacea. It will not drop the noise away entirely. And it's open to fidgeting. You can change the gain adjustments in many of them. You can change the timing constant so that the phase can be shifted a little bit. So you can play around with the signals rather than just hard-coded inverting one signal into another. If you're good with it, it could be useful to fidget around with it. Sometimes people make things even worse when they fidget too much.
Bandwidth doesn't play a part, right? If you cancel out the noise at one frequency, if you move the frequency, do you have to retune this thing?
Usually, yes. If you want to kind of squeeze the most out of it, because it has a lot to do with the frequency spectrum of the noise, even nearby noise does not have uniform frequency spectrum across wide bands. So they'll be more problematic at some frequencies than others, and tweaking the gain settings can have a beneficial effect. So people will regularly tweak those settings for the most part. I guess eventually some guys just get tired and or bored and just turn it on or off.
Yeah, I'll do anything. My best antenna, as you know, is my shortened MFET half-wave, but it is so noisy. It's incredibly noisy. And I think I just have to, for my own sake, try something like this to see if I can't, you know, eat into that noise somehow. Because surely my Kenwood, my old trusty Kenwood 440 isn't, I have to keep the attenuator on all the time. That's how noisy it is coming into my receiver. So I ordered it, as you know, from Russia, but it said the order was complete but not paid for, and I still haven't heard from the guy who builds these boxes, who got really good reviews on eHamNet. They're ridiculously expensive from like DX Engineering and MFJ for what they are, and there are two other companies that make them, but in reading the reviews, I hear they're ridiculously expensive for fairly simple circuitry. So anyway, when I get one, I'll report back. Back to net.
AC2GS. Oh, well, I wish you luck as always, Rich. It's not a new idea. It's been around for a while, and there are different price points. The MFJ is not terribly expensive. The DS Engineering is rather overpriced, in my humble opinion. I was fascinated when they announced it. They also sell different frequency modules optimized for those frequency ranges, and they've really put just kind of everything out there. So it's kind of interesting to see, if money is no object, so what the hell you can build. Whereas this Russian soldering together the components probably not as modular, but I hope it works for you. There's the one big variable that we really haven't discussed much, this is not really that much of great wisdom to offer you, is the sensing antenna is, of course, the most important aspect of this device. No doubt that there are configurations for a sensing antenna that will give you the best bang for your buck. Unfortunately, the only way to really prove or disprove it is to try different types of sensing antennas. A whip antenna, a loaded antenna, a long antenna, a short antenna. You know, you go on and on and on, all the possible antennas that you could, non-resonant antennas that you could use as a sensing antenna, and they'll all have an effect on the performance. So, I'll wish you luck.
I was thinking of using my 2-meter vertical, the one I'm using right now, as a sensing antenna, but that may be too much of an antenna, you know, maybe just, you know, 10 feet, 12 feet of wire running along the baseboard might be better. It'd be interesting to experiment with, that's for sure, and I have to imagine it'll kill some of this incredible noise I have. I have, you know, an S7 to S9 noise level. So somebody has to be coming in at 9 or 10 over for any kind of good signal. Thankfully, I do a lot of CW, so CW cuts through the noise much better than sideband, so it's not horrible all the time. But okay, like I said, I'll report back. Thanks, Roy. W2BZ.
Okay, very good. Also, for people out there listening, there are reports sometimes that these devices actually make things worse depending upon the circuit design. They are designed to do phase shifting. Sometimes they'll introduce phase distortions onto the signal, which is not a good thing. So your mileage might vary, but I look forward to hearing good news from Rich about this new experiment. I just want to mention Chris, K2STP, who's in the chat room, was kind of writing about what I was talking about earlier with my computer. I did do a disk check, if anyone thinks that maybe it was a bad sector or something, and according to the computer, the disk check came out fine. So it wasn't a solid-state drive sector problem. It most likely was some bizarre corruption of some files for who knows what reason, including either indexing files or configuration files or something that mysteriously did not chew up CPU cycles but just slowed down the process of installing and loading drivers and startup programs. Nevertheless, let's move on to our next person on our list tonight, Alex, AD2DU. How are you, and what can we do for you today?
Doing well. So I was out on Long Island last night visiting family, and I think I burned a pair of headphones out, and I was wondering if I could describe, maybe I did something super obvious wrong here. So the setup was TX500 radio, Alex loop, mag loop, and I wanted to just listen to the radio earbuds because my girlfriend was asleep. So I took a connector that came with a DigiRig where it splits out the mic speaker port on the TX500 into a mic, a headphone, and a push-to-talk. I'm going to let it drop. So it worked for a minute, then all of a sudden I felt my ears getting hot, and I think the earbuds totally burned out. So did I do something obvious wrong with, like, overdriving a regular pair of earbuds there? AD2DU.
Okay, that's an interesting one. Although I guess it is within the realm of possibility to do that. I would think that you couldn't really listen for very long because the amplitude would be painful. What another possibility might be, if it's not wired correctly, or it's kind of, unfortunately, a lot of companies use the same connectors, but don't make the same connection. So what's the push to talk in one of them is the listen, is the audio output in another. What brings to mind as a possibility is a lot of microphones today are what's known as condenser microphones. Condenser microphones are different than dynamic microphones. Dynamic microphones don't have a great deal of output, but don't need external power. They'll feed into an amplifier, and the rest is the radio. Condensers, though, have a built-in amplifier that requires a extra voltage potential. So a lot of these devices have a DC a voltage supply that's feeding the condenser microphone. And if you're wiring things the wrong way and you're supplying the DC power supply to a headset, to an earpiece, I guess it's not that difficult to burn the thing out under those circumstances. So I don't think it's just that you overpowered it. I guess it's possible, but I would think that it would be kind of obvious from the audio distortion of being overdriven. I think it's more likely, in my humble opinion, that the phantom power for a condenser microphone was going into your earpiece that are not designed for power supply voltages and currents.
I guess I should just Google what headphones people use with the TX500, because I was just using one that came with an off-the-shelf consumer AM/FM radio. It was a little scary, though, because my ears got hot. Like, I could think your butt got physically hot pretty quickly. Like, and it didn't sound weird before that. But I was guessing either a bad connector or the wrong type of headphone, maybe the ticket. You may be onto something. Over.
Yeah, if you have a voltometer, I would check out what kind of voltage and current is coming out of what you're plugging into your earpiece. Again, if you were overdriving the earpiece, I would think that the volume would be very loud and probably at that point distorted. You wouldn't have that if there was a nice, quiet, high voltage current DC power going into your earpieces that were designed for phantom power for a condenser microphone. So it wouldn't cause any kind of audio problem. It wouldn't cause any volume problem, but it would just burn up the coils because the coils aren't designed for relatively high current DC current going through them. They're used to just audio frequency signals going through the coil that the earpiece has.
I mean, should I not use regular off-the-shelf crappy earbuds with ham radio equipment?
Yes, to you.
Yeah, I just wanted to add a comment to that. I have heard somebody else saying that you can burn them out. Just like you said, phantom power, very thin wire, and it burns the voice coil out. What I would recommend, like you said, put a voltmeter on there, and if you want to use regular headphones, put a capacitor on. You can see out.
Yeah, that is certainly an option. If you place a capacitor, it'll block DC current. And if you just get a voltometer and see if there's a DC current going through it, you kind of know that there's something going wrong. I don't think that's a really good connector then. You really should not have anything that applies a phantom power to an earpiece. Phantom power usually goes to the microphone. So there's something miswired there as well. But we agree. I tend to think it's the only thing that makes sense to me personally is some DC current that should be there. It's always nice to say in the specs of the manufacturer if they have a particular type of earpiece. But again, there shouldn't be a phantom power on an earpiece. Earpieces don't require phantom power, at least all the ones that I've ever seen.
Yeah, I've never seen anything like it. It's a little scary when your ears get hot quickly. But I'll play around with it and see if I can throw a voltmeter up to it and learn anything from it. But I'm guessing the connector's just bad. But appreciate the insight, guys. Thanks for the help. Over. 82 to you.
Welcome, Alex. Thank you for participating. Once again, I am AC2GS, and this is the Limar Technical Net, and it's just 8:46, so the night is young. So if there are people out there with any questions or topics that they'd like to discuss, comments they'd like to make, feel free to hit that push to talk and give me your first name and your call sign.
The name is Keith, and the call sign is AC2, Mike Jones Thomas.
Okay, what can I do for you, Steve?
Hey, I got a question for you on antennas. I recently bought one of these ground-mounted HF verticals, 6-band, and muzzler. I forget the exact model of them. Trying to be mounted, basically straight on the ground, with the radios out, so forth, so on. What I want to do is I want to raise it up about, I'd say maybe 10, 12 feet top, and, on a, three-band mast or something, and, basically ground level to the mast itself, with something like that. My question is, will it affect the antenna?
Well, you might need to retweak it. The vertical kind of actually operate a little bit better with some elevation. A lot of times people will put up the radials at the same level as the base of the elevated antenna, and that will limit the ground coupling. The less ground coupling that you have, the less number of radials you need to deploy. When they're smack on the ground, the good number tends to be something in the 30s. Although if you look at elevated models with radials, a lot of times they have three or four simple radios. Depending upon how high above the ground. So if there's some way that you could mount the radial partially elevated, that would probably make it even better. But it might require a little bit of retuning. Changing any antenna's elevation tends to detune it ever so slightly. Just about every design I know of. That's why you can't really make sense of antennas that you test when they're in your house or on the ground, and then when you raise them up, they don't seem to work the same way.
N2KW.
Yes, N2KW. Long time, no talk.
Well, I do more listening than talking. This is Alan in Space Flight. Just a magic word. That's very low. Greatly misunderstood, very near to me, near and dear to my heart. And everything you said is true. The elevated radios are superior to ground-mounted radios. But I'll go a couple of steps further. Let me let it drop.
By the way, Alan, you seem to have a hum on your signal.
Yeah, I know about it. That's another subject. It's not going to change. But anyway, it's true that three elevated radios will give you superior performance to 30 radios on the ground. I'll also tell you the ground between radios, that there's no point in measuring them. If you have to have radios on the ground, just make it 50 yards, even if they're all different lengths, it's okay. But here's the kicker. For a vertically polarized antenna, the lowest angle of radiation is when the feed point is up a quarter of a wavelength. For a horizontally polarized antenna, you don't get good performance at low angles until you're up a half wavelength, and it doesn't really sink until you're up a wavelength. So if you understand that, it's a whole lot easier to put up a vertical. As a matter of fact, if you put up a vertical dipole up against the tree, that feed point is up a quarter of a wavelength, isn't it? And 2KW, all the...
Okay, very good, Alan. I appreciate your expertise. I've antenna simulations of antennas at different elevations. I published for the Limark newsletter the distribution as you change it in relation to its wavelength. You get below a half wavelength distance from the ground. You get a lot of ground absorption, a lot of reflection. It interacts and turns it into an increasingly near vertical incident sky wave, which is great if you want one, but not so great when you don't want one. And surprisingly, a half of a wavelength gives you, at least on the antenna simulation, a very, very nice distribution. You tend to get some funky distributions on the antenna simulators as you raise them higher and higher and higher above that one.
Are you talking about verticals? Because I'll stand by my statement that you get the lowest angle of radiation when the feed point is a quarter of a wave above the ground. I'll stand by that.
I was talking about horizontal.
Okay, now horizontal. We tend to memorize the plots. This is where a quarter wave looks like, this is what a half wave looks like. Just realize that they're both dynamic. And what happens with a horizontal antenna, you start out with the antenna too damn low, and it's radiating straight up. It's like a circle straight up. And as you raise the antenna, that circle splits into a heart. And as you continue to raise it up, that heart splits, and you get two lobes, and they get lower and lower. And when you get up about, I don't know, three quarters of the wavelength or so, it starts to develop a vertical circle again, which turns into a heart and splits. Ad nauseum, you keep on raising it, and it keeps on splitting, and it gets lower and lower and lower. But with a vertical, you've already achieved that with a feed point that's only a quarter of a wave up. That's beautiful, Albert.
Yeah, I agree with you, Alan. It's part of the beauty of verticals. I mean, they tend to be a wee bit more noisy than horizontals, but they are much more tolerant as far as positioning them than horizontals are. And, people get away with ground-based verticals. They do quite well if you properly shield them from ground coupling with a lot of radials. But elevating them is even better. You know, we all are operating most likely our disk repeater using a vertical with radials at their base.
check, and I check for two different animals. One, two separate things. Last thing I'm going to say is a lot of people think that the vertical is noisier than the horizontal antenna, but it isn't always so. I get a chance to work from a super station with very high beam antennas and four squares. And when you get rain static or any noise, the high antenna gets noisy, and the four squares molestably quiet and performs reasonably well. I should get a lot more bang for the buck out of a four square than you do out of anything. And I'm going to make that my final answer, KW out.
Okay, very good, Alan. Thank you for your input. Both of us aren't in an opportunity to have a gangbuster antenna system. We're lucky to get something that sort of works most of the time. So thank you. I appreciate it. I hope, Steve, you learned things from that discussion.
I most certainly did, yes. My only question is, now with the point by rings, for bringing the ground radios up, the last. I remember back in the day I had a custom thing that was on something, on 5 or something, and it had like 448 inch radios on the bottom of it. It sort of looked like a ring for an old, like a antenna type thing. Would something like that work? I still have the ground radios, the normal ground radios. If I would have just mounted that to the mast somehow, do you think that would be enough? Or do you think I could more of a expansive ground radio?
And 2KW.
Yes, Alan.
Okay, the R5 required minimal radios because it had a matching system. It was actually electrically a half wave, not a quarter wave. Didn't require the radio. Required the matching system in order to keep the transmitter happy. But no, those radios won't work on your quarter wave antenna. However, an inexpensive antenna that will handle a couple of hundred watts and bolt to the railing on your terrace is the Comet CHA-250B. I say again, Comet CHA-250B. Like the R5, it's electrically a half wavelength, doesn't require radios, covers 40 through 10. I worked a guy on 40 meters in Australia using one. It sold me. Over.
Okay, very good, Alan. Let me make sure I have the repeater. Okay, I don't know if we talked about this before. I think we did. My little gotcha with the CHA is that the Valen is a real lossy thing. It's practically a dummy load. So there's a lot of low SWR because there's a lot of diminished reflective power because it's being heated, it's being burnt up in the ballast. So, you know, although sometimes low efficiency will still get you to the places you need to go, it's not not exactly my idea of the perfect antenna, but it certainly is an option.
You want to hear a true story?
Certainly.
Larry Blumenthal, WA2RSB, had a 12 ABQ vertical mounted to the fence in his backyard in Brooklyn. And he lived in the same house for a while. The landlord, it was a two-family house, the landlord lived there too. One day the landlord said, why don't you put the antenna up on the roof? Larry never thought of it, so it, you know, he'd have a problem if he asked, but the landlord invited him. He said, sure. So he moved it up to the roof when they let it drop. Put it on a 10-foot mast, put three radials per band, and thought it was inferior to the antenna on the fence. And of course it wasn't. It was far more efficient. But he says, no. He says, the antenna on the fence covers both phone and CW. And when I moved it up to the roof, it got very narrow-banded. So, sometimes inefficiency is a good thing, over.
Yeah, like I said, I agree with you. It's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, we talked way back about traveling wave antennas, and traveling wave antennas are very inefficient because they have loading resistors at the end. They don't reflect back and have standing waves. They travel out, and then they are they burn up in the resistor. It is a well-respected antenna that does many jobs. So bottom line, ultimately, is what works for the individual's purposes. Whether it's 80% efficient or 2% efficient, whether it has a wide bandwidth or...